Well, please open your Bibles at the passage that Becky read for us a short while ago, 1 Samuel chapter 19. And you'll see, as we've been singing and as John has been pointing out throughout the service, that we're thinking about God as our sovereign protector, the one who is always at work in our lives. I loved playing rugby union that is. Until I suffered just one injury too many when I was 22 years old. My final game was played against Liverpool St Helens. I went out in a blaze of glory. Sadly, I didn't score a try, but I remember finishing the game despite cracking a vertebrae in my neck early in the second half. So that's got to say something, hasn't it? I started playing mini rugby when I was 9 or 10. And one of the first skills that we had to learn was how to tackle properly. And if you watch the professional game, most of the time you'll see people that end up with concussion actually forget the basics and they stick their head in front of the person they're tackling rather than behind. And it took a lot of practice to get this right because the aim is that you hit the other person and you knock them over without getting hurt yourself. And it took me a while to work out after many poor and tragic efforts that the key was to go in hard, to be aggressive, to aim to knock the fella off his feet. To do anything else would probably mean you'd get hurt. It's ironic, really, if you try to go easy, if you flinch at the point of impact because you're worried about what it might do, how you might feel, the pain that will come, you're probably going to feel a lot of pain. You're going to get hurt. Now, that's counterintuitive, but it's familiar to us, isn't it? In this and many other areas of life, we try to stay safe by avoiding risk, by seeking to protect ourselves. And in our passage this evening, we have two men. One who's committed to his own safety, and the other who is constantly at risk. Saul stayed at home in the palace, surrounded himself with servants and soldiers, cosseted by wealth and position, determined to stay safe and secure. And yet this man had no peace, had no real security. In fact, he was so paranoid, he couldn't rest until he'd eliminated anyone and everyone that stood in his way. Anyone that he perceived as a threat to him. And in this case, of course, that person was David. And then David, on the other hand, doesn't have any status, doesn't have any privileges, certainly not the privileges of Saul. He's the Lord's anointed. Chapter 18 is full of indications that this young man is blessed by God, yet he's always in danger, whether in battle or from the scheming of this evil king Saul. Now, a quick glance at these two men and their circumstances, and you could be forgiven for thinking that Saul was safe and secure, while David was most likely to end up dead. But that's not the case. David was actually the secure one. David was the one that was held in the hand of Almighty God. He's the one who was being protected by God at every turn. And as we work our way through the passage, we'll see how consistently and effectively God protected his servant David. In the course of the chapter, Saul tries to kill David 4 different times in 4 different ways. And each time, God delivers David from harm. So first of all, we're going to look at each of the assassination attempts, and then we're going to learn what this means for us as Christians today. So let's look at the first assassination attempt, verses 1-7, and God protects David through Jonathan. Chapter begins in verse 1 with Saul convening a secret staff meeting. And there's only one item on the agenda. He gathers his men around him and he says, "Look, guys, item number one, the only item that matters to me, how are we going to kill David?" Verse 1, Saul spoke to Jonathan, to all his servants, that they should kill David. No sooner had Saul unveiled this evil plan than Jonathan begins to intervene and work on David's behalf. In verses 2 and 3, we see Jonathan alert David to the threat, and then he goes to his father to speak with him. And Jonathan presents 3 types of argument to King Saul: a rational argument, a moral argument, and a theological argument. Look at the first of them in beginning of verse 4. A rational argument. Jonathan goes to his father, King Saul, and says to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you. In other words, he says, look, David hasn't sinned against you, so why should you sin against him? It's not logical. It's irrational. We'll come back in a moment to the fact that sin isn't logical. It's not rational. And then the moral argument at the end of verse 4, because his deeds have brought good to you. So Jonathan says, look, David has done nothing but bring you good and blessing, and you shouldn't repay good with evil. You should rather repay good for good. So it's a moral argument. And then in verse 5, there's a theological dimension. For David took his life in his hand and he struck down the Philistine, and the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? So he points him to God working through David on behalf of his people, and the fact that Saul himself has acknowledged that and rejoiced in that. But in response to this, Saul performs a U-turn. He promises that David will be safe, verse 6. Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan and swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Now that change is not the result of a changed heart. As we'll see very shortly, all that's happened here, I think, is that Saul has come to realize that he can't win the argument against Jonathan. It's a compelling argument, a strong argument. Jonathan was in the right, his father Saul was in the wrong. And notice that Jonathan says, look, you're going to be sinning against God if you pursue this murderous intent. So God protected David through the intervention of Jonathan, and then David in verse 7 is restored to his service in the presence of the king. That moves us to the second assassination attempt. Here in verses 8 to 10, Saul missed his target twice. You see, as we said a moment ago, sin is not rational. It is totally irrational. It's not logical, it's totally illogical. And we see that played out on a macro scale. Disobeying God, going against God's purposes and ways, doesn't make sense. It is not a wise, right, or healthy way to live. And we're seeing that played out in our nation in these days, as we see the same-sex marriage bill being driven through the Houses of Parliament. We are seeing that is irrational, sinful, illogical, that will be to the harm of society being driven through. Because sin, going against God's design, is never a good idea. It doesn't make sense. There will be serious consequences that will flow out for our society if that bill and others become law. And of course, at a more personal level, all of us can think of instances when we have deliberately gone against God's will and God's purpose and come to regret it. It is never logical, never rational to sin against God, to disobey him, to go against him. And that's exactly what we see Saul doing here, again and again and again. And here in these verses 8 to 10, it seems that peace and harmony reigns at the palace, but war breaks out again. And with war, David gains more success. He sent out to fight the Philistines. As before, he wins great victories. God is with him in all of these things. And Saul, his response is rage, jealousy, anger. And in these verses, we see it boil over. And as a man under the judgment of God, this evil spirit comes upon him. And as David tries to soothe his troubled soul and mind with music, Saul takes his javelin and tries once again to pin him to the wall, has two goes at it. And both times, David manages to dodge the spear. And then quite wisely, he decides it's better off to be at home with his wife than to be running around the palace trying to avoid a javelin. And God, the point is, God continued to protect his servant. That moves us to the third assassination attempt. Now he's gone home. But sadly, David's home is not his castle. Verses 11 to 17 of chapter 19. He goes home seeking safety. You can imagine if this is being played out as a film. We all enjoy watching these dramas, don't we, in these films. And you see the hero escaping from danger and you heave a sigh of relief. Oh, he's safe. But the minute he gets through his door at home, danger again. You see the tension building. And that's exactly what we have. Because Saul sends men to watch the house with the intention of killing David when he comes out of his front door the following morning. Now, Michael knew her father well enough to know that David had to respond quickly or he'd be done for. So verse 11b, she says to David, if you don't escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. You've got to do something now. Now, we don't know whether David and Michael's house was built into the wall of the city, very much in the way that Rahab's was, but it certainly seems likely. So Michael allows David down through a window, perhaps, and he escaped. And then she sets about buying her husband time so that he might make good his escape. The precise meaning of verse 13 isn't clear. We're told Michael took an image, laid it on the bed, put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with the clothes. Now, the images that we're talking about here are teraphim, or household or family gods. And that raises a number of questions for us, doesn't it? Does Michael place these gods in the bed so that they were dummies made to look like David being ill in bed? Or were they placed beside the bed as protectors of the ill? That was how they would have been used in pagan religion in those days. And then thirdly, what was Michael doing with these idols anyway when she served the true and living God? Now, they're all very interesting questions, but they move us away from the point. The overall picture is very simple. Michael is trying to create a diversion so that the hunt for her husband will be delayed. However, her quick-wittedness here earns her father's wrath, and she deceives him again. She's a bit of a deceiver, Michael. She deceives the soldiers who are sent by Saul in order to save David. And then she deceives her father by telling him a lie in verse 17. And Michael answered and said to Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? So in other words, he said, look, daddy, he was going to kill me. So I had to let him go. That was a lie. David didn't do or say that. So that's a third assassination attempt. And what do we see? God protected David this time through the intervention of Michal, his wife. And then fourthly and finally, in terms of these assassination attempts, God protected David by his spirit. Verses 18 through to 24. David, having escaped from his home, flees to Samuel at Ramah, pours out his heart to him, seeks help. And what can Samuel do? Verse 19 tells us that Saul had his informants everywhere, and soon his men were on the way to capture David. When the first group arrived, verse 20, a strange thing happened. At the end of verse 20 we read, when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing his head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul and they also prophesied. And then Saul sent a second group of men and a third group of men. But we're told the result was just the same. They also prophesied. Now what's going on here? What's happening? Well, remember, David's back is against the wall. The Lord's anointed is in grave danger. Saul is not giving up the chase. He's determined to run him down. He won't allow him to gain sanctuary, even in Samuel's company. So God acts by sending his spirit in raw, irresistible power on Saul's forces, causing them to be helpless. That's what's happening. Saul, back in the palace, hasn't got the point yet. He's probably hearing these reports coming back and he's thinking to himself, what are these people messing around at? If you want something done, you've got to do it yourself. So he himself sets out for Ramah. He's going to sort this issue out once and for all. But you see, God is no respecter of persons. And the king of Israel finds himself in exactly the same helpless position as all those squads of men that he sent to arrest David. You read the text carefully, you'll see that God stopped Saul even before he reached his intended destination. And notice also that, like his men, Saul is helpless for some time. Verse 24. He too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay naked all that day and all that night. And incidentally, when we read that Saul stripped off his clothes, it does not mean that he was buck naked, as the term might be. No, what we're reading about, what we're to understand from this, that he was undressed in the same way that Jonathan undressed himself in the previous chapter, in chapter 18, you remember? How, having knit himself to David, he demonstrates his submission to David, his loyalty to David, by taking off all his kingly apparel. And that's exactly what's happening with King Saul here. He's removing his royal robes as a sign of his submission to a higher authority, to God himself. So chapter 19 describes these four attempts to kill David. And each and every time, and in different ways, God protected his servant. And what we're talking about here is what theologians refer to as the providence of God. We could say that God's providence is his protection, his watchful care over his people and over every part of their lives. The most beautiful of the confessional statements, the Heidelberg Catechism on the issue of God's providence, says this. It asks two questions. What do you mean by the providence of God? Question 27. And the answer comes back like this. The Almighty and everywhere present power of God, whereby, as it were, by his hand, he upholds and governs heaven, earth, and all creatures, so that herbs and grass, rain and drought, fruitful and barren years, meat and drink, health and sickness, riches and poverty, yea, and all things come not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. Then the question follows, what advantage is it to us to know that God has created and by his providence does still uphold all things? And the answer comes back, that we may be patient in adversity, thankful in prosperity, and that in all things which may hereafter befall us, we place our firm trust in our faithful God and Father, that nothing shall separate us from his love, since all creatures are so in his hand that without his will they cannot so much as move. That is the providence of God, the sovereignty of God, the rule of God on behalf of his people and in their lives. So let's see what we can learn from David's experience of God's providence. And there are three things that I'd like us to see here. First of all, God's providence means that God is in complete control of your life and my life. Now, we read Psalm 59 at the beginning of the service, and it may help you to turn to that now, because it tells us how David responded to Saul's third assassination attempt, the one where he'd gone home and Michal deceived her father and his troops in order to facilitate his escape. And David writes this psalm in response to that occasion in his life. And I want you to notice especially how he ends the psalm. He describes the actions of his enemies, and then he ends with these words, verses 16 and 17. But I will sing of your strength. I will sing aloud of your steadfast love in the morning. For you have been to me a fortress and a refuge in the day of my distress. O my strength, I will sing praises to you, for you, O God, are my fortress, the God who shows me steadfast love. So you can imagine David in the passage that we've read, in that period of his life. He is on the run all the time. He's constantly looking over his shoulder. He's in fear of his life. Yet here he is, delighting in the God who is his fortress. Now, why does he do that? Well, a fortress is a place where you seek shelter, isn't it, when the enemy attacks. And David knew that God was his fortress, that God was in complete and total control of everything, that the God that he loved and served could be trusted in everything. Now imagine if David was an open theist. An open theist is someone who believes that God hasn't ordered and is therefore not in complete control of the future. There are things about the future that God doesn't know, because he can't know how a human being exercising their own free will is going to act in every circumstance. Therefore, God is not in complete control. That's what any open theist believes. Well, David can't be an open theist, because you would never describe God as your fortress if you believe he wasn't secure and he didn't know the future. He can't be a fortress or a source of security or comfort to you when you pass through trials or troubles. Why did David say this? Because he knew better. He knew that the God of Scripture can be trusted, can be relied upon, He is in complete control, and that's why this man, under pressure in the cauldron, fleeing for his life, can sing of God's strength, can delight in God's steadfast love. That's an interesting use of words, isn't it? Steadfast love. All this is going on around me. My life is in turmoil, yet God's love is steadfast toward me. Never diminishes, never grows weak, always there, always consistent. So we say that God's providence means that God is in complete control of all our lives and all our circumstances. The second thing, God's providence means that God is always at work in our lives and our circumstances. As we worked our way through the passage, we saw God using both Jonathan and Michael to protect David. It's great. God has a sense of humor. You know that, don't you? Here we see David, his anointed, being protected by the flesh and blood of King Saul. I think that's great. God can use all kinds of things and all kinds of people to act on his behalf. These were the means that God uses to protect his servant. But Samuel couldn't protect him. So God himself intervenes at that point. So there are times when watching over us and directing our lives and caring for us that God can completely bypass human means. Now, why does he do that? Well, he does it, I think, to teach us that our daily protection, our daily lives, the protection of those lives is supremely his work. He's never restricted by circumstances. He's never limited by situations. He's never outflanked by events. He's never bound to use specific means. And in your life and mine, God will always answer our specific need in the most effective and sometimes the most amazing and imaginative and unusual ways. But ultimately, when all is said and done, our salvation is always, always of the Lord. In other words, how we're delivered from danger, how we're delivered from trouble must never allow us to lose sight of the source of our deliverance, the Lord himself. Now, sometimes God reminds us of that by removing or withdrawing our usual means of help and support. Sometimes the props that we lean on are knocked away in order that we might turn to him and rely on him more completely as the source of our help in trouble. And I'm sure that David must have learned something of God's protection over him as he reflected on these events and what the Lord had done for him. Despite all that uncertainty, all the insecurity in his life, there was clear evidence that David hadn't been abandoned by God, hadn't been forsaken by God. That's so important, isn't it? Because people can sometimes think, things are going badly for me, I'm in trouble, I'm facing hardship, so somehow God must have turned away from me or abandoned me. That was not the case with David. You see that, don't you? He was a man who, we're told, knew the blessing of God in multiple ways, yet his life was tough. It was difficult. God hadn't abandoned him in his trouble. God hadn't forsaken him. I came across a really helpful quote, and it was this: sometimes the clearest evidence that God has not deserted you is not that you're successfully past your trial, but that you're still on your feet in the middle of it. That's worth saying again, isn't it? Sometimes the clearest evidence that God has not deserted you is not that you're successfully past your trial, but that you're still on your feet in the middle of it. God's been gracious to you. And you see, David learned to see God at work in his trials. That's why Psalm 59 ends with these words of praise. He's in the cauldron and he's singing, "I will sing of your strength. I will sing aloud of your steadfast love in the morning. Nothing will deflect me from praising you and honoring you in my life. Because you've been a fortress, you've been a refuge. Oh, my strength, I'll sing praises to you." Oh, that God would give us the grace, the ability to be able to respond to hardship and difficulty in that way. Can you understand what David's saying there? Can you see God's protection, God's providence at work in the trials that you may be facing in your life today? It's one of the most difficult things to learn, isn't it? Reading God's providence is extremely difficult. It's best done backwards, as someone has said. As you look back on your life, you see what God was doing at certain times in your experience. But we need to learn to develop this ability to acknowledge that God is at work in all the circumstances, in the good times and the bad. We need to acknowledge that He is our refuge. He is our defense. He is our strength. As the psalmist says, God is an ever-present help in trouble. Third thing I want you to see is that God's providence means that hard things may come into our lives. That's fairly obvious, isn't it? We've already reflected on that. The Lord was with David. The Lord was with David is the refrain that runs through chapter 18. Yet we see attempt after attempt after attempt on David's life, him running for cover. And God's providence means that there will be hard things for us to deal with. John Flavel, one of the Puritans, wrote a book, The Mystery of Providence. And in it he says these words: all the dark, intricate, puzzling providences at which we were sometimes so offended and sometimes amazed, which we could neither reconcile with the promise nor with each other, nay, which we so unjustly censured and bitterly bewailed, as if they had fallen out quite against our happiness. So you see what he's doing? He that chimes with our experience so much, doesn't it? That troubles come and we say, well, what is God doing? We bewail our condition. We're bitter about what's going on, as if God is somehow seeking to squash our happiness. And then he goes on, he says, we shall then see to be to us as the difficult passage through the wilderness was to Israel, the right way to a city of habitation. So he says it's the hard things that seem to bring us so much unhappiness and difficulty that God uses to lead us directly to the heavenly city, to his presence, purifying us for a happier and better enjoyment of that place. Now, I would hazard a guess that there's no one here this evening that has a contract out on them. I hope not, anyway. But imagine that there's someone out to kill you. How does that kind of trouble compare with the trouble you're now in? David's boss wanted him dead. Now, you mightn't like your boss. Might be pretty awkward, might be pretty difficult. But does he or she actually want you dead? Are you scared to go home tonight in case there's a contract killer at the door? Well, no, I trust that's not your experience. Yet here David finds himself with his life threatened, his marriage disrupted. And where is God in all of this? Well, he's working nevertheless. Remember William Cooper's famous hymn, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable mines of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. Try to work out what God is doing in all of this. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. Now imagine being in on the conversation between David and Samuel. David flees from Saul. He comes to Samuel, almost like a father in the faith. And he says to him, Samuel, you anointed me as king. Since then, there have been 6 attempts on my life. One or two of those attempts have come pretty close. What's God doing in my life? And Samuel says, David, I can't tell you, but I know this. God knows what he's doing. He knows the end from the beginning. He will make it plain, if not in this life, when you see him in glory. See, knowing that God is our fortress doesn't mean that our lives will never be difficult, that we'll never face danger, that we'll never be burdened by grief or sorrow. But we do know this: we are immortal until our work here is done. It is appointed to man once to die, then the judgment. That means that the day of your death and the day of my death is already known to our loving
Heavenly Father. You will not die. I will not die a second earlier or a second later than a sovereign God has decreed. That's wonderfully comforting, isn't it? Doesn't mean that we're reckless. Doesn't mean that we ride motorcycles at 150 miles an hour without crash helmets and say, well, God's decreed the day of my death and, you know, I'll see if it's today. We don't live carelessly or recklessly. But it brings us comfort to know that we will not leave this life. We will not go into his presence until everything that he has ordained for us to be and do has been accomplished. You and I won't share David's experiences, I hope. We won't have to run for our lives from crazy monarchs. But we do need to know David's God. God's promise, providence is a source of tremendous comfort. Three things very quickly that we can take away based on the Heidelberg Catechism. One, we can be patient when things go against us. Joseph's imprisonment in Egypt seemed pointless and unjust at the time, didn't it? But we know differently. We look back on that event and we see that it makes sense, that God was at work, that his purposes were perfect. Think of this, the killing of the Messiah seemed senseless and pointless at the time. But we look back with joy and thanksgiving because it makes perfect sense now. And then think about your circumstances. Seen this way, maybe God does know what he's doing with the pain and the hardship that you're wrestling with at the moment. Second thing, we can be thankful when things go well. How often do we pray and ask God for daily blessing, daily mercy, daily help, and never stop to give thanks to him? Never stop to say grace. See, God's providence means that everything comes from his hand by his grace. And therefore, we should be a thankful people, giving God thanks for everything that we enjoy today. And then thirdly, we can have confidence for the future. You see, the thing is, all your worries may come true. All of those things that cause you to be anxious may happen. But God will never fail you. He will always lead you. He will always listen to you. And his ways are perfect. God moves in mysterious ways, and that means that we might not always understand why life is as it is today. But it certainly helps us to face the future unafraid, to know the one whose hand mysteriously moves all things. This is the God that we serve and that we worship. So are you enjoying God's protection on your life? Are you giving thanks? Are you being patient in trouble? Do you have confidence for the future in him? If you are, then you can sing the words of our closing hymn. A sovereign protector I have, unseen, yet forever at hand, unchangeably faithful to save, almighty to rule and command.